I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Thank you all very much for coming to the London Review Bookshop. It's a real pleasure to see you all. We are delighted to have Ruth Padell reading from Watershed, published by Hazel Press. Thank you, Ruth. Thank you, Daphne, and everyone at Hazel Press, as ever. We also have Sean Barrowdale, another Hazel Press poet. Our poets will both read, talk to each other, perhaps about the shared concerns in their work, and there'll be time for questions at the end. Please give our guests a huge round of applause. Thank you both so much for being here.
Well, thank you, and good evening, everybody, and thank you all for coming. And it's the launch of this book, which is published by one of the most wonderful new presses in the last few years to have risen like a star. And this is Hazel Press, which is a completely ecological press. And the wonderful editor and my friend is here tonight, Daphne Astor. And she is the first person I have to thank after you for coming. And after Sean for coming to talk about this. We've read before together, haven't we?
We have in Edinburgh, I think.
Yes, and then we both had poems sort of about the earth. I was doing emeralds and you were doing tunnels.
That's right, caves and tunnels and yes. Swallows. Yeah.
And now I'm doing water, and Sean has this lovely book on insects, and also a book with Hazel Press about more insects, about Sylvia Plath and bees. But I've also just discovered that he should be writing about water. He probably is, because in lockdown, he built a boat he's living on. So, that's wonderful. I also have some other thanks. These poems are about water and climate denial. And they started 10 years ago when I saw the most wonderful thing. I don't know if any of you saw it in Somerset House, the Museum of Water. By Amy Sharrox. I see little yes, and that was really so exciting, and that started these poems off. And then also to Writers Rebel, I recorded a very early version of these poems for them when they were doing their event at Tufton Street, which is the heart of climate denial and at the moment here, and I just recorded them on a mobile phone. And it was on their website. And I don't know, is Vic Sharma here? He's a composer who just set my voice on the mobile and all its crackly fragility to music in the most wonderful way. I just wanted to thank everybody for that. So what we're going to do is I'm going to read a few poems from the book which Sean has picked out, and then we'll discuss them. And then I want to talk a lot and introduce, Sean's work and how our interests relate. And I'm so pleased that you said yes to coming tonight, because I guess poets at the moment, with our great tradition of nature poetry, The big question is, how can you write about it? How can you write about it in a way that takes poetry further, that takes poetry seriously further? There's lament, there's anger, there's doom, but you also have to make a poem. And that's, so we might be talking about that. All right, so I'm going to start with some of the poems that Sean picked out. And he liked the title of this one. And I think we both share an interest in interesting titles. And I was thinking about a title of a poem is kind of like a frame for a painting, that it focuses it focuses where you look, where the light goes. And this one is called All the World's Fresh Water in One Bubble Over Atlanta, Georgia. Groundwater, swamp water, rain gullies, rivers, ditches, and ponds. And that's it. A map of the only fresh water on the planet. Wind whips the lagoon into bubble froth soap suds and wet wipes blocking the drain. Your hands shake like rags in a gale before the eternal night of an exoplanet raining metal vapor and liquid gems. One side facing its own star, scorching in light, the other in infinite dark. You wait for the augury, sing to the brook. Life flies out and away, a blackbird shrieking alarm from a leafless branch. So that was a poem which had spaces between some of the words and the line. This is a poem which is just a block poem, a long, thin one, in a different voice. And I suppose water is an important thing for a poet to think about because of form and formlessness and how form goes and what liquid does. Water God, I have no form without a container or the saving minerals of a rock and clay. Unscrew the glass bottles, inhale a whiff of Charybdis. I'll go my own way, separate into steam. You can't hold me back. I am sparkle, wave ripple, sky talk. You'll see the ocean suck itself dry, then a death wall, a tsunami blocking the heavens. You'll seek me in depths of the Bolivian desert and the water table of the Chaco Boreal. You won't know if I'm coming or going, but when I'm gone, you turn to prayer. And I'm there with a vengeance, flood of reproach, flood of tears, 40 blue days, 40 black nights, a tide of dysentery and plague. Look for me in spray at the end of the hose pipe, end of the rainbow, end of the year, when light fails in the Arctic Circle. I seep up through bubbles of loose plaster, dead matter crusted with light. You need me like God. Pour me out of a tap as lightly as stroking the dog, and treat me as a metaphor for the sacred. But who, if I call now, would hear? I know these are rather dark. There's a little sparkle of hope at the end. This one goes into myth, rather. Lady of the Lake. And the translucent sperm of microplastics in rain, in our food, in every human placenta. Probably the placentas of water voles, too, swimming towards their breakfast of floating flowers, as if The divided fishtail of Melusine waved at the weir below the factory and smothered the whole surface in froth. Islands and pinnacles shredding away from their own crests, glimmering like net trim on a ball gown, gossamer breaking to quicksilver, and a white hand thrust up through the whole mess, offering a sword and a tambourine to every river in Arthurian England, bubbling with iridescent chemicals, prescription drugs, and raw sewage released from the veins of every current 400 times a year. Everything we need to think about and don't. The Atlantic jet stream speeding up, Australia, Spain, California on fire, and children all over the globe injected with a blast of climate terror, climate guilt, straight into the hippocampus. As if a pub in that crystal cave at the end of the world held a darts match for the blind. And the boards were our bodies, our hearts. So the last one I'm going to read in this is, it's called Hope is a Lamp Made of Water. And I just want to tell you a little bit about that. There is a renewable energy startup company in Colombia which has developed a small lamp that turns salt water into light, and it brings power to communities without access to electricity. And it's based on the fishing practices of a people called the Wayuu, whose system of justice, I love this, whose system of justice, which is resolving conflict through mediation and negotiation, is recognized by UNESCO as part of the intangible cultural heritage of humanity. I think that's just extraordinary. And the poem is sort of shaped by a rather complicated lamp. I don't know why it just got like that. Hope is a lamp made of water. Now you are leaving, dip your hand in the sea. Scoop up the blue and green lozenges of all your past years. Electrolytes in a liter of salt water gathered by the Wayuu indigenous community on the remote La Guajira Peninsula. Desert surrounded by ocean at the dangerous border between Colombia and Venezuela, who use salt water to light their night fishing. Electrical energy without needing to travel to find it. Power you don't have to buy from other people. A light source, new life running underneath this one. Pour everything in, hoping the magic will happen. Ionization will turn the raw mix into 1,000 days of light. An invention that might save the world. Like your hand on my arm, skin on skin, one mind understanding another. So I'll stop there for the moment. But I'd like to ask Sean, really, you know, what made you choose those poems? Why did you respond to those in particular?
I was fascinated in turn to know how you how these poems, because my sense of this book, having read it a number of times, is that it travels so quickly. So the voice and the observing, the sort of the poet observatory, if you like, I had a sense that suddenly outer space wasn't far away, but actually very close, and I think it's the transport, it's the quickness with which this it's like you do mention a water spirit in one of the poems. You've taken those water spirits that have fallen slightly redundant,
yes,
in our world, and you've kind of drawn them into sort of, it's rather like this lamp. You've managed to convert them into a sort of energy source to look and to scrutinize the whole world. Mm. And it's the sort of the deafness that I find that exists between the poems, I found incredible. And so I suppose these to me sort of had a, there were different facets that came to light. So this one was hopeful, the one you've just read. And it was also, it does occupy this form, and I was fascinated by your, and I'm so glad you mentioned it, the relationship between, you know, because we can't speak as climate scientists, obviously, but we can try to speak as poets in some capacity. And there's something about how does the poem work and how do the pressures that bear upon existence, experience, language, how does that change our relationship to what poetry might be able to do, and how can we try to push that and move that?
Yeah, you talked in one email about moving between fields of focus and trying to hold or find a position of knowing. And you felt that there was a strong pragmatic urge. I think that's partly because I'm writing a desperate trying to finish a book on elephants, a non-fiction book on elephants, and I'm feeling so practical about that because of the conservation of it. So there is this practicality. But in one of those poems, when I'm really hitting it hard about how awful it is and, you know, people putting raw sewage and everything into it, I try to lighten it with the tone and sort of talking about the pot with the water bowls.
Yeah.
How do you do it? Because you're doing the things too. I mean, his book on insects is very much about, you know, how vulnerable these insects on which we all depend are to the world. And but you do it in a quite different way.
A different range, a different focal range, perhaps. And I think, the idea, but these, your poems do zoom. You were able to zoom into very intimate details and then zoom back out very quickly. And in that sense, I had this strange feeling that your kind of poetic observatory was actually a globule of water, like a droplet of water in the mist swirling around the planet. And then I had that odd sense of, do you know, in Paradise Lost, where Satan is kind of moving around the edge and there's a sort of rustling, almost like static in the sort of outer atmosphere. And it was a sense that your kind of little globule of water could have moved
evolving
in that way.
Yeah.
And it was I found that remarkable that sort of exists between the poems. No poem states that directly, but somehow that's the sense that comes out of them. The other thing that comes out, and you mentioned it, is the elegiac or the elegy, or the lament as part of elegy. And there is a reference, I don't know if it is a reference to the Duino, to Rilke's Who If I Called Out or Cried Out Would Hear Me. But that turn, just a reminder of the elegiac and how important it is to embrace that fully, because it is a feeling that many people experience now. There is a kind of the everyday lament, and how we kind of hold that and use that to some potential rather than something that sort of pulls us down.
Yes.
And I feel that very strongly in these poems, that you're really trying to find a way to render that lament useful in some way.
Yes, that's an interesting question, isn't it? How is lament useful? Is it useful to other people? It might be your own grief, but how do you make it radiate? In a useful way.
Yeah.
Let's go to some of yours, and I want to sort of hear how you make it. There's the one about the effects of that one, the effect of a petrol engine lawnmower.
Oh, yeah. Okay. these aren't disconnected to yours at all.
Exactly.
I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about the world that we live in is a world that and you mentioned this in terms of making, we make stories and we live through our stories, and maybe in some sense that's all we have. And the world is a kind of story. It's a story that we share, and bits of it don't add up and bits of it don't fit one another's versions of that story. But nevertheless, it kind of is a, and the idea of a world is a sort of, as much as a fiction as it is something that we can lay in fact. And so this idea of a lawnmower and mowing kind of creates a certain world that we can kind of feel that we have our sort of world around us. It is a very wonderful thing to mow lawn in the right conditions. And then you have that lovely almond smell in the evening of the cut grass and so on. But there's another side where, what if that lawnmower does something which completely swerves your sense of world out of itself? And I think this was a way to try to deal with that. So effect of a petrol engined lawnmower. Moths rise from the earth, bony papers that resurrect lightly. Blood so dry it sticks to the mouth. The sky is a mouth. The mower's workspace, its blade spinning urges them up, up. Reflexes deprived of body mass leak. What have I done? Ants drag work the area, down again, down, down into the vault of their undertow, down into their hospital of unmentioned anniversaries, unmarked births, a social infallible emergency they trust to restore. Ands and more ands. A ground badged with sores, down, again, down. To re-impregnate, to re-audition, to rethink earth, to harbour eggs.
I love that word, to re-audition and rethink earth. And that really, that's one of the things that we both want to do.
Yeah, I suppose. And it is how do we sort of restaging our sort of what life can be and how we fit within that.
Yeah, I love the way you bring in self sometimes. The devil's coach horse beetle? There's a sense, if I zoom out to the world and back, and you zoom into the self and back again in a way.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, this the self always for me feels problematic as a poet. I think it's a real like a huge eclipse to seeing so much else. But then the self is also only made by what is there in some sense. So, do you mean the one on the left or the right?
Well, I was thinking, either of them, whichever you think would be more appropriate. Maybe the moment of witness is a good one.
Okay. Yeah, there's two. It's a kind of diptych, and I found myself in this book writing a number of diptychs, partly because I felt that I never had quite one relationship to something, and I wanted to have another go at it. It's also about rehearsal, and I feel that poems are very often rehearsals for something that you're trying to say, and so to have versions to not commit to just there being this is the poem, but actually this is the sense that I'm trying to sort of.
It's a very painterly way of thinking about it, because painters often do a sort of whole series of paintings, of Cézanne's card play or something like that.
Yeah, and also I suppose I trained as a printmaker, and I know with etchings you have states, so you take a state, you take a proof, and you see what happens, and you work back into it. Mm. So you end up with a whole collection of images that are not quite the same. So I sort of playing with that. Devil's coach horse, beautiful black beetles that very shy. You get them in damp, probably slightly dirty houses. And we had quite a few. They come out at night. They're very beautiful. Devil's coach horse beetles slowly through a moment of witness. Even here, its artery is of black silence, juddering over painted concrete of the kitchen floor. A silent siren carrying a consequence of its entering. The beetle articulates furiously on time. So still, so thickened, I cannot cross it after it, but hold it, opening across me, closing across me. Is it a kinship? What will I do with an us that absorbs me? Have I mentioned the barbs, the fringed bristles along the legs, the segments of antennae, the prismatic sheen across blackness, each part immaculate, unbruised, unchafed as something born? No, but in the slow whirlpool of the room, to have passed a beetle on nearly equal terms.
Yes, I love that. And I might just remind us all that actually we started off tonight exactly the same moment that David Attenborough's Wild Isles were starting on TV, and this sense of looking and also being looked back. So it's a moment of witness on the nearly equal terms.
Yeah, it's so fragile though, that, isn't it? It's you know, you sort of, also it's a sort of quantum thing. You try and scrutinize something and it changes it. So you know, your presence.
Yes.
Changes it, which I guess with the water is an absolute.
Well, when I was doing this, and also I want to thank my wonderful editor, because she pushed me you know, sometimes you say, there isn't enough sparkle in this roof. I could read a poem that I read, Real Wretched Sparkle.
Please do. Yeah.
This is the last one. It's called Water Bearer, because Aquarius, and I don't know very much about astrology, but there's the signs like that of a water bearer are for the sign of lightning, I think, which I suppose is something going between earth and sky, water, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I looked up various things about the water bearer. And I was also thinking, I suppose, you know, I'm thinking about the young and what sort of world are they going to inherit and what are they going to do with it? And what is hope and how things change? All that is coming into it. Water bearer. Rope dancer, plate spinner, blazing out in two bolts of lightning, nymph with a thousand names, angel in the desert, pure energy pouring to earth, water blown by wind, spark of enlightenment descending from heaven, translating darkness to light. She, he, the wide open anywhere, poised at the jump zone, carrying a skin to the creek or to a river legally recognized as a person, where there still is light dance and spindrift, new worlds in every eddy, moon trails on the lake, reflection, refraction, ripple and play, water dazzle, the witness of rain and the longing for horizon, even in a world going up in flames, at the precipice, which is also the edge of epiphany, and whatever lies beyond, for the ivory acrobat, girl or girl boy, diving like liquid through air, reaching out to the monster's horns as a drop dies in the river of its joy.
I love that. With certainly sparkle, it's extraordinary image. You seem to draw your poems, I mean, it accomplishes extraordinary final images, like the darts match inside, yeah. You know, in the cave. And the other thing that happens very, very sort of seems to flourish in these poems is the sort of the way that you make questions. It's like water itself is a sort of question making.
Yes, you said that. Yes.
State, if you like, or.
Yeah,
and I was fascinated by that because they're not. For example, in the poem "Angel of Refraction," and you sort of open this sort of conversational tone, and it just what flows from you to me will come back seeking its own level, but different, like the bent path of a light wave. And I just that to me is, you know, the all of these poems are a form of refraction. You know, that you're yeah. using the prismatic quality of water to sort of pass the voice through it and to find something, you know, which isn't just the sort of despair and the awful kind of realities that seem to be kind of, you know, gathering, but there's maybe a path through it. And I think the poem that you just read is a way of it seems, you know, that you refract, you find things and then you put them through with the voice, you know, and then something happens which maybe can take us somewhere else.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a sense yes, you have.
Funny to hear your own work sort of reinterpreted in this
place. Yeah. I guess my question is how did these poems happen? Because you have such a wide range of subjects and a lot of things that you've brought into them. And did it take a long time to write this, or was it a sort of flood?
Yes. No, it took 10 years.
Yeah.
I started it. Because I just joined King's College and somebody at King's asked me to write about or respond to the new wonderful Museum of Water. If you don't know about the Museum of Water, look it up on the net. She went around getting lots of little asking for stories. Stories is something perhaps which comes into you. Stories about little bits of water. So somebody sent in water from the moon or water from the depths of the sea or water from a melting snowman or something like that, or a baby's first bath. And gradually these stories accumulate, and it was beautifully done. Yeah. And she's taken it around and people have added it to it. So I got very excited about that. And then I responded to various other things. And then I mean, things like when my daughter was on her gap year and she was in Bolivia, and there was this thing I mentioned, the Chaco Boreal. And so I was sensitized to the Chaco Boreal, and apparently it has a very high water table. And while she was away, I discovered that George Bush's advisors had told him to buy up a whole lot of the Chaco Boreal because of the water in it. You know, and I suddenly thought water is, you know, the 21st century oil. And this thing about all the world's fresh water in one bubble, I found a map of all the water in the world. And, you know, there's a whole picture of a map of the world like that spread out on a screen. And there's this one tiny bubble over Georgia. And that's the fresh water, all the rest is salt. And, you know, how fragile water is, but also how terrifying the floods that we've had and so on. So so that all came in. And poetry is just such a, well, condensation is the very word we're after, isn't it? You condense everything. Yes. Read another of yours. There was another one you were going to read. Well, the hot bright visionary flies. I love those flies.
That I sort of funny. I wrote that and I thought, God, I felt like I couldn't ever write anything again because of the way it sort of states its ending. But anyway, trying to break that promise to make.
You will. it's the ending poem. It's a small one. And yeah. And also these poems are rather like insects. They have little feelers that go out here and there, and there's a sort of wonderful fragility about them. And yet we depend on insects for our lives.
Well, yes, and I suppose I'd kept bees before I wrote this, and so I had the problem of being the keeper and whatever that entails. I realised that I wasn't really a keeper, that I just poked and created problems for the bees, and then had it's kind of horrific, really, when you really examine what happens when you open a beehive. You kind of do tear open their house. Actually, the house is a part of their own organ. It's part of their own being. It's not just a house. It's wax that they've formed. It's secreted. It's a very organic completion, and so that act of tearing it open is horrific, really. So I started to think very much about the act of keeping, and then also what a house is. We put bees in hives. They don't exist in hives. They exist in nests. They find holes and nests, and they burrow into the ground if they're bumblebees and so on. But hives are what we make for them. We make them little houses, so little pieces of machinery. And I suppose our sense of, you know, we're talking about the environment and the ecological and eco, you know, that's the Greek root is house. And so I guess a lot of that is to do with housekeeping, and a lot of the anxiety that we're facing is a sort of one of housekeeping in some sense, and how economy fits that. And I, whilst keeping bees, I also started to think about, well, what about the insects that I'm not keeping, but those who are sort of keeping me or keeping us? And started to look around the house, the actual house that I was living in, and just trying to find places of proximity and to think about that proximity, and wondering about, like, who is the real inhabitant here? You know, because we'd lived in the house for a few years, we were the only generation with our children to live there. But what are the insects, I presume, have had countless generations there. So really, are they the inhabitants? And we're the incomers, we're the blow-ins. So it's, you know, my sense of time changed through these encounters, and also my sense of what proximity could be. How close can I get to something that I really don't know? On almost any terms. And usually the sort of condition of housekeeping is to banish insects. But it was impossible to banish them in this house, I must admit. But I started to like their presence. It was interesting. And then around the house to like the sense, and rather like your water droplets in the air, that I, on some days you could look up and see the insects in the air, and there were so many of them. It was teeming with insects. So this last poem is a sense of that sort of glance. Hot, bright, visionary flies. The hot lozenge lifts, uprisings, downfalls, a ticking beyond sound, a red square of falling sun, a mass breathing, beating, a sky studded with stones, fraught with cut light, an abolished mechanics at dewdrop scale, onyx, topaz, opal, each a dull pulsing. One day it will stop. The air will stop. The light will stop.
Well, the last word in the book.
I don't know, yeah, or maybe telling myself to stop. Because I think when you're writing certain things, it can be sort of close in on you. It can become obsessive because it sort of has to be. You have to instrumentalize yourself and attune yourself to that particular thing. And so you start to see the whole world through this. Everything you do becomes sort of aligned with that activity of process of trying to think through the language barrier something.
Matthew Sweeney used to say that towards the end of a collection, the last poems you write in the collection are sort of feeling their way to the next thing you're going to be thinking about. But maybe that's not always true.
Are there poems here that sort of kind of make a sort of jump out into?
I don't know, but I think perhaps stories. I think the
the stories is fascinating.
The story thing.
And this comes, and actually even in the light poem, I love this. This way you talk about the magic will happen, ionization will turn the raw mix into 1,000 days of light. And then that's an inversion, of course, of 1,000 nights, which is the sort of biding time or trying to survive, either way, through storytelling.
Yes. And shall I read the one about water stories written by men?
Because that would be lovely. In fact, I would read that. Yeah.
So I suppose there is a quite sort of female thing through the poems, because water and liquidity and flowing and transformation, at least that's one of the narratives swirling around femaleness as we think about it today. So this is water stories written by men. Here is the dark amber cistern out of the foundations of Istanbul, dedicated to Medusa and her devastating eyes. Here are 9 translucent ice columns, midsummer muses drawn from the core of 9 Icelandic glaciers, each warming at a different rate. And here is the golden fleece, the sparkle of sunlight at Colchis on the Black Sea, where the Princess Medea, just a young girl, will fall in love with an adventurer sailing in to steal the gloss off the surface. In the story as written by a man, she will betray her father, her brother, and who she was meant to be. All her lovely botanical knowledge, herbs she gathered of healing and changing, will do her no good at all. Let's tell it for ourselves. Make her the guardian of a dream waiting to be born on a mirage-prone border, like this river that has suddenly appeared between you and me. Let her be a corona of mist, drifting, thinning, turning to rain. So I suppose I'm thinking there that stories keep changing, and just as water keeps changing, their form, their importance, their meanings.
I love the way that you state the sort of the you know, in myth there's always a sort of an eternal present in mythic stories, and you sort of allow that to switch, because she, you know, just a young girl will fall in love. And will betray her father. But you give this opportunity to sort of switch that and let the, in a way, the eternal instant be an opportunity to try another course. And I think that's very powerful in this poem. And I love that dream waiting to be born on a mirage-prone border like this river. It's stunning. It's just this.
Thank you. I think this is a lot of, this is about relationships and about the water level between relationships and how it's always changing. And whereas I think you've got this in this book, there's Inmates, there's a lot of between you and the insect, you and the observer and the natural world. Here, I'm thinking of the water as the unconscious of the self, but also in the shifting relationships, constantly shifting between one person and another, between self and other.
And
so that happens in myth all the time.
Yes, constant transferals of power.
Yes,
in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to? There are the angel of refraction, which.
Okay. Yes. Yes, you like that one.
I don't know. Coming back to that one, it was just that sort of. I did sort of quote a little from it a minute ago, but
yeah. I mean, because it's so mysterious when you look at a stick, and it bends in the water. And I suppose I was thinking of that, really, the refraction. But also, again, of what happens between two people as they speak. And, you know, my words go out to you and you hear them differently from how I meant them, and your words come into me. And what happens to once my words have been in you, what will I feel about them then? And that kind of thing. But so water became such an image of what goes on between people as well as what is in your mind. And, of course, what we are. Angel of refraction. What flows from you to me will come back, seeking its own level, but different, like the bent path of a light wave passing to water from air. The stories we tell about ourselves may not be true, but they're all we have. A door in perspective, half open, a wobble at one remove of stars and moon. I offer mine as if they were true, trusting you to deal with me truly too. Who is there now to remember who you were at the hour of your birth, when the wind changed and the owl in the chimney swung round in its cowl? How will you feel now about what you said? What has it become? Where has it been? And what is this owl gaze into the soul, the glug, glug, glug of between? I'm doing quite a lot of rhyming at the end of
the poem. That's interesting rhyming. But the rhyming is interesting because it's a sort of, again, it's that sort of difference of level, isn't it, sort of occurring. And it's not quite, the rhyme is never quite absolute. So it's not...
No, it's not pattern.
No, but it allows those sort of levels or you know, that sort of thing when water changes level and it still has to settle.
Yes.
I feel the rhyme sort of does that. It's the glug glug is very, it's sort of, it's time as well. So you bring time into that poem.
Yes, an hourglass time or drips of water.
Hmm.
Yes. Well, why don't you read one more? Which is the other one that you were... Oh, yeah, the demoiselle emergence.
Oh, yeah.
Which I felt was a sort of pupa or something coming out.
Well, I mean, it mentions prison. I mean, the book is called Inmates, and... I mean, inmates is a, to use your word, wobble. It's a kind of wobbly word. It has the inmates, of course, the imprisoned, those kept. But I also had Coleridge's Frost of Midnight in my mind because of that domestic setting and inmates, these cottage inmates that he refers to as family at night asleep. But you have a sense that the inmates are greater than that as well, that there are other inclusions in that. And I also like that poem, Frost of Midnight, because it's part of a small group that he called to conversation pieces. And so there's a sense that they're not quite poems, but they're slightly in a slightly kind of raw state in some sense. And they document moments. And so these poems are doing that. They document moments. And I tried to think of them not as poems, but as those kind of language places where something, you know, sort of they sort of, you peel them off, a bit like prints or something. So this is, Bande de Demoiselles emergence. So it's the sort of emergence of an insect. Everything has gates or a door. The prison is open. The door into the glare, blind within its darkness. Everything winds and shines. The moment glares coupled to the moment the glare is sworn through. That stick bent, or that stick snapped. What is the difference? A horizontal line drawn over a pot implies a handle. Around a pit trap serves as a lip.
That's wonderful. Yes.
Actually, I was reminded of your refracted stick.
Yes, you know, we've got sort of bent sticks in common. Yes. But I think we should stop in a minute. But I thought maybe I'll read the first poem in the book, which is very little. And it's really about how we, well, how denial works. We all know, you know, things are dark out there. And this image that I saw in a paper was just sort of sums it up. But also how amazing things are. Selfie with blue-ringed octopus. Bad dreams ignored. Lit raindrops on windows of the midnight bus, and then a footstep behind you. Like the girl on the Sydney beach who picked up a tiny blue-ringed octopus. Most dangerous creature in the sea, for a selfie. It rested in the cup of her hand, one small jelly spider, two legs folded under, as if it were on its knees, praying. So, thank you very much, Sean.
And
would you want any questions? And we've got 10 minutes for questions. We've stopped beautifully in time for 10 minutes for questions. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. It was really lovely. And a privilege. It is a privilege to hear not just one, but two poets reading their own work, talking about their work, sharing in conversation. And what I want to ask both of you is how you feel about the practice of talking about the writing of a particular poem, and because it leads so easily into a kind of explanation or sharing of the thinking and the context. Whereas, of course, if I go tomorrow and pick up the book and turn to that page, what I will have is the written, printed words. And from that, I can read the poem again, once and then again to know or to try to fathom what is in the words and behind the words. And I wonder whether you feel that it helps to have the chance to talk in conversation and explain or recount.
It's, well, refraction comes to mind, but as a sort of changed perspective on what, I mean, I feel that my relationship to my own poems changes all the time. And if I'm asked a question by Ruth here, my relationship, it will change my relationship. It's an interesting process. I also think the words on the page are sort of, there's a gap. There's always a gap, and that's I suppose that's why it works in some sense, is that the reader can come along and change the nature of those words by the act of reading. So I suppose to explain, it's not, I don't feel I'm explaining, maybe I'm trying to explain something to myself if someone asks me, so I can understand what the question is in some senses. But it does, I do feel it's an open, it's not a finished process for me.
It's never a finished process, yeah. It's interesting. I mean, poets can talk endlessly to each other, but it's you can talk about the writing of it. So, I mean, I did notice that this thing I mentioned, the Museum of Water, has got into a lot of these poems, and I could think about that, and I could talk about that for an hour, as you could probably talk about just one room of insects in an hour in your house. But I suppose it's interesting to see how somebody else takes their experience and puts it and wants to put it into this strange form. I mean, it's a very weird thing to do, to write a poem. You spend hours, days, weeks, well, 10 years, and on these things, and it's a totally uneconomical activity. And it's, and you know, a tiny number of people on the in London, let alone on the planet, will ever read it. But and why do you want to make it? What's so important about doing this? It's to concentrate experience and then to refract it, to offer it, I suppose. So it's interesting to talk about it, but it doesn't take away. But you can read the poem. Just a poem belongs to its reader.
Well, first of all, thank you. It's been fascinating, both of you, with your different poems. I mean, I've written one or two non-fiction things, but I've never, ever been as clever as this. I mean, you say that took you 10 years. Is that because you put it down for a couple of years? Or is it because you sort of suddenly thought, I'll have another go tomorrow, and then I'll have another go tomorrow? So first of all, I just wonder. And then this business about going back, I'm a terror for going back over things I've done. And how much of the change on both of you do you make? Do you think you do a poem, that's it, gone? Or do you think you sort of think, I'll just make another word here, another word there.
Well,
First of all, I just think it's brilliant. As a non-poetry person, I came for you, Ruth, and I'm glad I came.
Well, when I say it took 10 years, I mean, I started these poems 10 years ago, but I have written quite a lot of other books in between. And I do think that that's an important thing. You do something in the white heat of something, and then you lay it down. And it changes while it's sitting in the drawer on your laptop or something. And then, you know, and I did it. I've done various, you know, some of the poems were published in India, some of them were published in other places. And then I did the sort of sequence for Writers Rebel. And that was interesting because they were 24 then. And I was thinking of, I suppose I was thinking of the Odyssey or something, you know, 24 books. Well, these are 24 splashes of denial. So right from the beginning, it was about climate change and the horror of denial. And, you know, and denial seems to be getting worse and worse. And I think that's because society is getting more and more afraid. So there is a tsunami of whatever is coming at us, but there's also the tsunami of denial, which is riding up inside people. So I was constantly thinking of that while I was doing other things. And then when Daphne kindly accepted the poems for her pamphlets, which are these very concise, beautiful shape. Then she really pushed me. She said, I don't like that bit. Cross that out, you know, good, big slashes through it. And what about this? This is the thing to work on. And, you know, so that was very exciting. You were a very, very creative editor, as I am sure other people in this room. And then, you know, you let something go and you leave it and you do other things and you come back to it. I don't know, what's your experience?
It's interesting, the relationship with the editing process, because these poems, actually I wrote this, I wrote four books at once, but over about 10 years, and I kept notebooks, and I kept a set of notebooks for each of these books, not knowing what the book was, apart from one of them, which was a very specific poem journal of beekeeping. The others grew very slowly around that, and were just spaces that I allowed to happen, and very slowly they formed a kind of concentration of their own, and a sort of selection process of their own, and became this one was very aligned to the insect, but I didn't know whether it was part of an insect, a sort of commune of sorts, or whether I was subjecting them to something. I didn't know what the relationship was. So the idea of the inmates grew very slowly. It probably only occurred at the end of that. In terms of writing over a long period, I thank my editor now. At the time, I cursed my editor because I gave him the manuscript and nothing happened for a year. I didn't hear anything.
Was that Robin?
It was Robin. And I waited and waited but of course in that year I lived with the poems and they completely changed. So when he asked me to send it to him again, because it had been sort of lost under the sort of heaps of things that probably grow, the manuscript was different. And actually it does take a lot of time. You do have to live with something. It's a strange, you can't just write the poem. And so, I mean, it's very rare that a collection of poems just happens. And I think you need time. And it's, again, that adds to the strange economy of the poem, because it is a perfectly, in terms of, you know, time value and you know, sort of being useful to you in other areas of life, it just sort of, it's like a sink. You know, things just sort of fall into them and never come out again. But there's a value to that, one hopes, in that I feel that the registers that the poem kind of works with are very close to the registers that we're probably concerned about. in the world.
Yeah.
You know, the tiny things, the increments, the things that we don't notice very easily, but feel now that there's a sort of consciousness growing of that. And I suppose that's where denial comes in, because it's very difficult to think of such huge incremental change. And I feel poems are sort of calibrations in that. So they do require calibrating in that sense as well.
I suppose I was trying to write poems about the wish not to see, or the wish not to think, or the wish or something. Mm. And that was
not to
think about things, the wish not to see things. And that took a long time to realise that that's what I was writing about. And I think, I mean, writing poems, it's very rare that you know what you're going to do in advance, and you have to be able to bear not knowing. Mm. Have we got to stop?
Hello. First of all, thank you very much. That was unbelievably inspiring. But Ruth, you said something interesting. Also maybe a question for the people who make books. At some point, we're all here because we love the sound of language and rhythm, and it moves us. And I guess, and bear with me because I'm trying to formalize this question, but like, would you consider yourself an environmentalist poet? And just hold on just for a second. And I read recently somewhere in the state, I'm from the States, that something like 80% of poems that are published in the States are from most people from urban areas. You know, in the United States, it's a huge area, but so not necessarily everyone may have a seat at the table or be heard, let's say, because here, you know, we're here in London. And so my question is, I'm struggling here with this. I'm not quite sure what I'm trying to say, but when does a poem, in your mind, are you thinking of global warming? Or when does a poem cross into a poem that may actually, do you think about that type of thing? Versus, say, just an observational poem of a landscape or a working class man and a woman in Maine.
I think about global warming all the time.
Right, right.
And I don't think of myself as an environmentalist poet. I think of myself as an environmentalist and a poet, just as I'm a woman and a poet, and I'm 5'6" or whatever I am, and a poet. I'm not a 5'6" poet. the whole of my life, I'm thinking about conservation, and nature, and I guess the same as you.
Yeah, I think about global warming, and I'm glad you use that term, because that's, we call about climate change, and it's not quite accurate, doesn't really give an indication of where things are going. Global warming, yes, I think about that a lot, and I have children, and I worry for them and their friends, and but I do find these sort of to be say an environmentalist poet, or I particularly dislike nature poet, because I think nature is a word that is like it's like fast food. There's very little nutritional value in the word nature, and I think it's like a huge roadblock as well. So it has problems. So to be a poet and to be concerned with other things, the poetry serves as a sort of a means that we sort of work out, but there are other things that it has to have conversations with.
And also, I mean, there's a lot of anger in this, there's a lot of despair in this and everything, but you can't, most poems written out of anger and despair are not very good poems. You've got to be it's got to be a good poem first. Otherwise, it betrays poetry as well as betraying its message.
I'm not a poetry person either, but I am a visual person. I was struck by quite how visual your poems are, and particularly your metaphor of refraction, and thinking how many, particularly of your poems that are about pollution and so on, seem to be about a kind of optical illusion. You have this beautiful sparkle that turns out to be pollution or something, litter or something terrible. And I wonder if you might say a bit more about the role of the visual in the work, words and images, and how they work together in poetry, if it's not too wild and woolly in general, the question.
No, it's not at all. It's absolutely cardinal. But it's also true of Sean, of course, because he's an artist as well as a poet. I realized more and more in the last sort of few years that actually the visual for me is a sort of another dimension of how I think about poetry. And I wasn't trained in art, and art for me is a wonderful playground. You know, I don't have to know the things. It's a place where I can enjoy experience without knowing. Whereas so much of, I was a classical scholar first, so a lot of those things are, you know, I feel I have to know them. I've written a lot of poems about paintings, and I see things. And I think going back to titles for a moment, and my idea about the title as a sort of frame for it. And I think I was thinking about how does the light get into a painting, and how does a painter put the light in, and where does the light come from? And then what do we do about, you know, Sean's sort of, when he calls one of his poems "The Effect of the Lawnmower," that's so different from just saying a lawnmower or mowing the lawn or whatever it was. So the tones and registers of the words you use are like light for a painter, or maybe like white for a painter. I don't know. So that you can shade it, and I think I'm constantly thinking of that. Not at first. At first, I go at the poem, and then I start to build it up and palette it or whatever it is. Does that make sense? I mean, but Sean will have a completely different answer to that.
I think that's a really interesting idea, actually. I'd not thought of it quite like that, but the title being kind of almost the sort of direction of light into the poem and the way that you light the poem. That's very interesting. I suppose I am concerned. I think of compounds of words and the way that they sort of holds them together as material, very material. I trained as a visual artist, but I feel that sort of materiality of language, that there's something of the history of words and the way that you might use certain materials as a sculptor or painter to draw something into the work that isn't necessarily visible at first glance, if that makes sense. It's a knowledge of the materials themselves and their provenance. And I feel that maybe work more in the work of sculptors, who would use certain materials. I mean, Joseph Beuys is a famous example for using felt and fat and so on. And I find that with words, that compounding is very like mixing pigments. It's sort of drawing another colour out of a range that don't contain that colour necessarily.
But also the cover of this is his redreaming Sylvia Plath as a queen bee, which Hazel published. And you know, my sense of relationships of between words in a poem is very like some of these cells, because they're constantly shifting and moving. And when you're finally getting to the final surface of a poem, it is you're just grading it and change a little bit, change the word there a bit, and everything shifts. It's very exciting.
It's very true, like the wing of a.
Exactly, the wings are the ones as I was thinking of. Claire, ought we to be stopping?
I'm too busy thinking about light being shone onto the bones and how the cells on the cover of Sean's book. I'm busy. No, that was amazing. Thank you so much. Thank you all for your questions and contributions. Please do stick around. Come and buy some books, get them signed. Thank you both so much. Ruth Padel, Sean Borrodell. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.